Are you ever feeling stressed? Guess what? You're not alone. I've got the author of this particular document. We're going to take a look at the state of stress in cybersecurity and see maybe what you can do about it. Stick around. Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. I'm your host, G. Mark Hardy, and today I have Steve Shelton with me. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, G. Mark. Glad to be here.
Well, Steve, you put this thing out, The State of Stress in Cybersecurity 2025. But before we get into that, because I think it's a content that's going to be of most use to people, what might be interesting to people is a little bit about you. So tell me a little bit about who you are and how did you end up doing stress management and cybersecurity?
So I'll start by giving you my personal philosophy, because I think that's the foundation for everything that I do. One, my personal philosophy is to be the light. So the idea behind that is that I very much believe we're all here to grow and evolve throughout life and try to reach towards our own potentials. And so that means being a leader in your own life and finding out what your purpose and your passion is and living those things daily. So that's first and foremost. And then behind that, I spent 20 years selling cybersecurity software and supporting the community. And so I developed a very intimate knowledge on the industry and what it takes and what the experience is for everybody from an analyst to engineer all the way up to a CISO. And I say that because of the fact I experienced my own burnout in the industry probably multiple times and left to do something that I thought would have more of a positive impact to myself, but also others in the world around me. So I have a background with social emotional learning, which is all character development. I played football through college. And so I wanted to connect back into the sports roots. I left to become a performance psychologist. And so that's really my focus is performance psychology and helping others perform their best.
Wow. It's kind of interesting. It sounds, first of all, I would say that stress is a feature of our industry. It just seems to be that, hey, if you're going to get into cybersecurity, particularly on cybersecurity leadership, expect it. Stress, though, and let's talk about stress just for a moment before we get into more details. Is stress necessarily a bad thing?
It's not necessarily a bad thing. The challenge is understanding, like, we think of this in terms of a bell curve concept. So the top of that bell curve being there's an optimal level of stress in regards to your ability to perform well. And so the positive aspects of stress we refer to as eustress. That's the type of stuff of like the friction we feel when we're starting a new job, trying a new hobby, doing things that are not necessarily automatic and easy for us, right? But the outcomes are much more positive than the friction that we feel, so to speak, in trying that thing or doing that thing. The challenge for us in cybersecurity or any other profession or experience is the fact when stress becomes managed ineffectively and it starts kicking in that survival instinct. And that survival instinct is running too long. That becomes chronic distress, and that chronic distress starts to have negative repercussions in terms of decision-making, ability to have attentive and take in information from other sources that might be helpful in those decisions. And then the physical aspect of how that's impacting your mind, your body, and your emotional state.
So stress is a physiological reaction, may not be a bad thing. If we're going to big game or you're going ahead and you're getting psyched up for something, you're going to feel like a little pressure, and that pressure might be actually a good thing. It's going to cause you to be more alert, more aware. You're a little bit more sensitized to your inputs. And like anything else, almost like an adrenaline where, hey, there's a big bear that just poked its nose out of the bushes. Now is a good time to run or fight, but probably run in this case is a better choice. Your mileage may vary. But in that particular case, though, with the elevated stress, you get the cortisol up, you get the adrenaline going. Yeah, that's going to keep you alive. And that makes sense for man 5,000 years ago. Well, today, most of our stress inputs do not involve large furry mammals poking their nose out of a berry bush at you thinking, lunch. Rather, it comes through our work, through our interactions with other people, technology. I just got off the call as I got onto recording this with one of my clients who was facing some stress because her OneDrive settings had backed up the entire corporate SharePoint to her hard drive, and she's wondering why she can't get any work done. And so we were solving that problem. But that's one of those things where she's all stressed out. I got a big meeting coming up and I got to get ready and things such as that. In that particular case, the stress doesn't make you more effective, in my opinion. And I'm going to ask for you because you're more the expert. Stress helps you mobilize fight or flight. Go ahead and, if you will, the lizard brain, that basically the early response, but it's not going to cause me to come up with more creative thinking. How about we do this and we'll reach around the back and we'll come up with that answer. And we got it. Stress works against you. And I agree with you because your decision skills making goes down from the ability to respond effectively, correctly, in some cases, even being able to stay focused on task. If you've got all the alligators around you, you forget your original task was to drain the swamp. You're swatting alligators, to use that analogy. So stress, it's there. We accept it. It's sometimes worse than in other cases. But why do you think it's so prevalent in cybersecurity? And that's almost a silly question because you could be talking for the rest of the episode on that. But what do you think are the top things in our career that probably make it more stressful than doing other things, for example?
So you mentioned a couple of things I want to hit on, and I'll tie that into the answer to that question. So first, stress, the definition is really the natural human response to the threats and challenges in our environment. It's a really important distinction, on threats and challenges. If we deem something a threat, like that tiger hiding in the bushes, the bear that was going to kill us 5,000 years ago, there's a direct component or correlation to that thing has the ability to cause me harm, pain, or death. So therefore, it's a threat. I don't have the resources to overcome that thing. Versus if we look at that same thing as a challenge, as, oh, that bear is going to help me run faster and longer. That's a challenge I'm willing to take on. That means we feel like we have the resources to manage that demand in our environment, right? Similarly, you mentioned the feeling nervous versus when you're feeling stress. If you deem and interpret the meaning to be, I feel nervous versus excited, one person could experience that, or excuse me, two people can experience the same situation and stimulus. One can respond and think that they're nervous and fearful versus somebody else can see that same stimulus and experience and say, I might be nervous, but I'm also really excited. Right? That's a much more empowering feeling or thought process. So all those things are really important because that plays into the cybersecurity environments of cybersecurity environments are very much referred to and compared to a wartime environment, the volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous environments. The challenge is that the military professionals get trained for the environment that they're going to be operating into and how to try to manage themselves to complete the mission. Differently in cybersecurity, most of us are not getting trained mentally and emotionally in terms of what environment we're going into and how to respond to that. And then also the environment that they're operating in or the system that we're operating in cybersecurity, there's a lot of variables that add additional stress burden and actually drive the burnout more so than our individual abilities to manage stress.
It's rather interesting. And so I think you've hit on a couple of key points. One of them being is that as a military veteran, I'm quite familiar with what it's like to be in stressful situations. And as a result, we fall back on our training. And there's a saying from Admiral Rickover, who is the father of the nuclear Navy, had said, anyone who stops to think in the middle of a crisis shows a severe lack of training. And so if we have to stop and think, if we're not sure what to do, if we're like a squirrel in the middle of the road, left, right, we'll usually end up getting squished. If you run left or you run right, you have a better chance of survival because you probably get off of that road. And so we don't have CISO training courses. We do not have a series of progressive leadership qualification gates like we do in the military that as you work your way up from, for example, a junior enlisted or junior officer to the point where you're senior and you're actually leading combat operations, there's a different requirement there, and the skill sets are going to be different. The demands are going to be different. But again, if you've got the training, you could do that. And so it almost kind of begs the question, and for a long time, going all the way back to 2008, 2010, where the Rockefeller Snow Act was the federal government's attempt to go ahead and legislate cybersecurity. And for those who are historians, you can look up Rockefeller Snow with an E at the end to find out what that proposed legislation was, which didn't take place, by the way. And in the way we had the discussion back then saying, do we really want the federal government telling us who we have to be and what we have to do? And like a CPA has certain requirements because you can't just call yourself a CPA. Or if you want to be a doctor or an attorney, you can't just call yourself a lawyer without having, well, you could be a lawyer, but without passing the bar. But then that's pretty obvious. But as a CISO, some of us just come up from the ranks and they just said, hey, we just fired everybody else. You're the only person left. You're the CISO. Okay, thank you very much. Is there a solution on the horizon for that? Or are we still going to be run around over the next several years like a bunch of independents that some of us will have tremendously valuable skills and capabilities because of our experience and training? Other of us are going to find ourselves under the bus because we didn't know how we got there. Or we just don't know till it hits. What's going to happen?
So I was going to add a little, maybe disclaimer is the right word, when you said that there's no training in the environment for these skill sets to train cybersecurity professionals for the environments they're going into. There's no training yet. Uh-huh. So the research that we did last year that you pointed out at the beginning of the session there, there's a lot of interesting findings that came out of that. And we're using a lot of that to build an online platform to deliver these trainings from an asynchronous standpoint. We also at Green Shoe, again, the biggest employer of what we do as performance psychology professionals is the U.S. military. So there is a large network of performance psychologists working with special forces, aviation pilots, et cetera, teaching them how to manage their mindsets for the environment that they're going into and actually perform and perform at their highest levels. So those components combined, we're building out a platform right now that we call Grow, very cleverly combining Green and Shoe, so G-R-O-E, but calling it Grow as we're working to develop and grow these skills that are very much needed in the industry. The idea also is that we're providing some ability to measure stress levels, energy levels, and these components, because the research we found asking those 40 CISOs we interviewed across the country, how long does it take you to recover from a stressful situation or incident? And the 100% response was a blank stare of, what are you talking about? Because it's not something that we measure in the industry. So if you don't measure it, you have no way to manage or change it. And that's what we really want to provide, is that context to be able to say, what is your energy levels? Because this connects directly into motivation and performance. So employee engagement, retention, productivity. And if we're not measuring these things that impact motivation and our ability to perform in the environment, we're not going to be able to manage or change those things.
That's a very good point. I'm looking at some of the documents. I'm not going to go here through page by page, but I want to note that I will put this in the show notes. It looks like you can download a copy of this report, and that's good. You make that available to everybody. So thank you very much for your contribution to the industry. But, you know, quoting from a book of stress, 63% of CISOs that you've talked to experiencing burnout, 61% cite excessive expectations. Your average CISO tenure anywhere between 18 and 35 months, shorter than a CFO, shorter than chief legal. In fact, the turnover is pretty high. And if you, those of us who are on LinkedIn, we see studies and information all the time suggesting thoughts and ideas for that. And but what are your thoughts? I've got my own, but I want to get yours. These are symptoms. These aren't causes. These are symptoms of what?
So I think it's a two-prong component. So the research and we provided the first empirical research on stress and burnout in cybersecurity. There was really no empirical research prior to this study. But there is a variety of research and empirical research on stress and burnout in workplace environments, and kind of kicked off in the late 70s in the healthcare environments with emergency rooms, triage nurses and doctors, which is still an issue right now. But the idea being that there's environmental or systemic factors, six of them that we look at and the research had basically developed or uncovered. One is your ability, and this is outlined in the research also, or the state of stress report. One is your ability to feel like you have the resources to manage your workload.
Mm-hmm.
If you feel overwhelmed by your workload and you don't have the resources to manage it, you're going to feel fear over pain and all that stuff connecting back into the lizard brain aspect of things. But also, if you're bored, if you're not being utilized to your full capacity and you're being underutilized, boredom also leads to burnout.
I wonder how many CISOs are facing from boredom. Anybody out there? Just put a comment in our link. I don't expect to hear any, but if so, that sounds like an interesting problem. But yeah, you're right. People kind of spin their wheels a little bit if they're not given enough stimulation. By the way, I'm going to inject on here that people who are new to leadership roles who don't understand effective team management and delegation, or they're so worried about looking good that they go ahead and they try to get everything done themselves to make sure it looks right, end up having a bunch of undertasked, therefore bored people, because, well, the boss is trying to do everything and the boss only cares about himself or herself and the boss is blah, blah, instead of understanding where you can take a chance with a subordinate and trust them with something that doesn't have to be done perfectly. Because when we learn to walk, when we learn to ride a bicycle, we just don't boom, hit it, nail it. We got to fail a few times. And I think one of the keys to effective leadership, which is also a de-stressor, by the way, is know where it's okay to experience failure. Not abject, total failure, but it goes wrong. It reports wrong. The number wasn't right. Okay, fine. Didn't break the world. Company didn't shut down. But is it a learning opportunity? And can the person that did it, who made a mistake, you sit down and say, well, let's figure out why this didn't work out right. But let them go ahead and fail a little bit. And I think, by the way, that solves both of those issues, both from the stress. I'm worried about this. It's okay. That one can be not okay. All right. And this person, hey, my boss cares about me. I might have too much to do, but I have it. Okay. So let me go back to the Steve Shelton show, already in progress.
No. So that, again, we could probably spend multiple episodes just on that, the leadership component of it. And that connects into a lot of points in terms of those six areas where we call those the six areas of job fit. Dr. Christina Maslich and Dr. Michael Leiter's research really uncovered those, workload being one, and then also the control and autonomy components.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, as an individual, have the ability to make decisions on how you do your job, when you do your job, where you do your job, et cetera? Or do you have a boss that's doing all the work for you and not allowing you that autonomy that you just mentioned, right? So that leadership style, that also is one of the things identified in the research, is the leadership personas or traits and their styles and how they either increase efficacy through trust and delegation, or are you hoarding that control and trying to do everything yourself? Because the challenge in that is that it's not a static definition. So you may be somebody that defaults into hands-on keyboard because that was where you were really competent, is doing those technical components. But as a leader, your job is no longer hands-on keyboard. You're empowering others to do the work for you. So it may work to be a default tactical CISO or leader, depending on your environment. And there's other environments where that doesn't work because you need to delegate, trust, empower others around you to align to that mission and do the work.
Yeah. So it's really two phones, you know, that. And of course, then the problem, which often comes from above, which is giving the responsibility, but not the authority. And I think that's hugely stressful, where we go through a cycle where what happens? You need a CISO. Why? Because you had a breach. So the last one left or was fired. You step in and you say, okay, what do you need to do this? You do your 90-day plan, you go ahead and you work things out, you submit your budget to the board tries to argue it down, you go ahead and say, but that's a risk. They said, okay, fine, yeah, we'll deal with it. Then the breach happens, and now you get all the money that you could have had, a lot more than you needed to prevent the breach, to go ahead and solve it. But then they want reports every day, they want to know what you're doing, they want to keep it, and then you burn out your person, and then they leave, and then you lather, rinse, repeat, is compared to having very, very clear empowerment and direction from the very top. at which point, for example, the board intervenes and the CEO intervenes, and you sit down with the head of development and said, you shall not release code until this CISO approves it. And that is critical path. I don't care how badly your customer wants it. We're not going to release bad code. We're not going to release insecure code. I used to work with a guy in the Navy, and we used to call him S14. And then I ran into him at SANS. We were fellow SANS instructors. And I remember bumping into the guy and said, hey, Pete Skepinkevich, how are you doing? And he looked at me. He's like, how could you pronounce my name? I said, I'm from Buffalo. We had all these Polish guys. He said, I'm from Buffalo. And it turned out that we weren't so far apart. But Pete had a job. I don't know if he still has it at the time. But at the time, he was working at IBM. And he was in that gatekeeper role where when they're getting ready to do a commercial release, that he could be the in-series circuit breaker to say, this thing has not been properly vetted or has insecure code or whatever, we're not putting it out. And no matter how much these people yelled at him, senior management said, nope, that's his job. That's why he's there. So in a way, that sounds rather idealistic, but that to me, although it might be a busy job, the stress might be going ahead and looking at a lot of stuff. In my opinion, that's a better type of stress than being held accountable for results over which you have no authority. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, so one of the biggest challenges for CISOs and cybersecurity professionals is that aspect of the responsibility without the authority.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a major challenge because that hits on that aspect of control. The other aspect, because there's so many components and variables of stressors in the environment that we're all dealing with, and one of the top ones that I hear from a lot of CISOs is just dealing with other people. And just because something is important to you, if you're not empowered, nobody else is going to care. So just because it's important to you doesn't mean anybody else cares about that outside of your role in your department. So understanding like what are the incentives, but connecting back into those six areas of job fit or what leads to stress and burnout. One of those is your values, which is what you're hitting on. So what's your organization's values? Most companies put those up on their office walls, their websites, their annual reports, but the majority of us are not living those day in and day out with all of our decisions and our behaviors. So part of the challenge is what is your value? If you're putting your revenues above your values in terms of caring for your clients, then you're going to push out that code without ensuring that it's fully vetted and it's not going to cause harm to your customer base, right? So knowing what those values are really important, but also are you taking care of and rewarding your CISO and your team members, not just financially, but also, because I just had a conversation yesterday, but financial rewards are a part of it. Are you also getting the recognition for just doing a really good job? Because if people aren't acknowledging the value that you're contributing to the organization, you're going to feel like nobody cares. So what's the point?
And I think that acknowledgement is correct. If you look back in the little shadow box I have up here with the military experience in the back, we could not give our military personnel bonus, cash awards. I couldn't give them stock options. I could not go ahead and say, hey, go ahead and here's an arbitrary promotion because those are usually controlled centrally. You can't go ahead and do an awful lot of the motivation things that you could otherwise do other than provide them with recognition and more hard work. And if you as a leader can produce outstanding results from a team with that limited toolbox, when you get into the corporate world where you have all these extra tools, you think you're like, wow, this ought to be pretty straightforward. But a lot of times we miss that. And we miss that because we're so focused on getting things done, the unbelievable size of that inbox, that we're not taking the time to develop our people. And as a result, whether it's the type of leader you are that is going to make an impact and how effectively you utilize your team, and then how well you're going to go ahead and incur stress. So to go back to your report, and for those who are watching on YouTube, you ought to be able to see that. Hopefully that focuses in, although I try to keep my camera from zooming in and out with the autofocus. You talk about different types of leaders: strategic, adaptive, tactical, and operational. Can we dive into that a little bit, please? Because that looks like some really interesting ways to look at different approaches.
Yeah, so it's a lot of what we were just hitting on in regards to trust and delegation and that type of thing. There's a trend historically through cybersecurity and IT, but cybersecurity specifically, of you start off in an entry-level role, your hands on keyboard, you get really technically proficient or competent at that skill set, and somebody above you sees that and says, we should promote you to a management position so you can train five others to be just as effective as you were doing that stuff. So it's like, great, I get a promotion, I get more money, more responsibility, my career path is growing, but now you're a little bit of a step away from that hands-on keyboard, and now you require other skill sets to motivate, manage, lead, all these components that are really human skills, that there's really not a lot of effective training in the industry for us on those skills. And to your point previously, there's different demands when you move from a individual contributor into a manager, into a director, and then as you continue to progress up into the CISO, there's a variety of different demands that each step up requires, and there's not a lot of effective training into those components, right? So understanding what's your default in terms of your personality type and how you engage, how you understand yourself in relation to others, how you motivate and connect with others and all these things, that's not something you're born with, and it's very much trainable skills. So being able to provide that allows us really to understand, like, how do we engage with others and how do we lift them up and help them get more out of what they're wanting to get out of in terms of their career and work towards this vision that we're all working towards.
Yeah, I often talk about the four levels of a career where you go technical and then management and then leadership and then political. And these are all orthogonal. And as you're saying this, I'm writing down different type of skill sets, going from technical to people to organizational to political, where those are orthogonal, as I said. Just because I'm a brilliant technician doesn't mean I'm good with people. In fact, often they tend to be counter indicators. If I'm good with people and I can be a great member of a local team, but I don't align with the organization, that can be a problem. And even if you're aligned with the organization, but you miss the overall understanding that at the very top, people are people. And as a result, the highest level decisions are always political. By that, I don't mean elected politics. I mean, it's sources of power competing for what comes next. And you maybe not having that power, being able to identify sources of power that'll support you, create an exchange of value where you come ahead, even though this person's got more power than you. But more importantly, and I think very critically, if there's a negative source of power that's trying to drive you down, you can mobilize this more powerful thing to counteract that so it doesn't defeat your initiatives, your career, your team, whatever it is that you're looking at. So you talk about results analysis. Again, I'm not going to read through the report, but signed your tactical CISO, and this sort of like, you know that you're a redneck if or whatever. Your tactical CISO, signed your strategic CISO, signs it, things like that. And it talks about leadership style change and things such as that. Do our leadership styles represent our preferences, or are they hardwired? I'm left-handed, and I would be hard-pressed to write as well with my right hand as I do with my left. I guess it's possible. If I had a stroke or something like that, I would retrain. But in general, that's hardwired into me. How about leadership styles? Are those hardwired? Are they learned? And are they malleable?
So leadership is a skill that can be learned based on the research that we operate off of. So the idea here is that we all are a product of our own nature, but also our environment. So coming up, we learn, especially as kids, how to just survive our environment that we're growing up into and try to find the most safe route, so to speak, for us psychologically, emotionally, and physically as possible. The challenge, though, is that, again, most of us, as we grow up, are not learning these styles in terms of, like, how do we communicate effectively? We learn what's easiest for us in our environment and operate out of that first and foremost. Mm-hmm. So the idea becomes then, how do we learn and unlearn some behaviors that are not serving us anymore as adults? But then how do we learn what actually helps us and serves us based upon the person that we've grown into, and then based upon the person that we want to be and need to be in our own lives and our environments? It's a really important component there, because that takes a lot of reflection. It takes a lot of understanding what's most important for us, what are we working towards, and then how do we actually develop the senses and the skills to actually
help empower us towards that pursuit.
And I concur with you that leadership is a skill that can be learned. Again, going back to my Navy training, Arleigh Burke, who was the longest serving chief of naval operations, had said, I don't remember the exact quote, but he basically said, leadership can be learned. It's hard, it's difficult, it requires a lot of effort, but anyone can become a leader if you work at it hard enough. As compared to like anybody can be a football player, like you played football and well, I didn't because I was, I remember in high school, I was 6'2" and 131 when I took my first Navy physical at the age of 17. They're like, really? I go, yeah, I had to get a waiver because I was so underweight. And, but they took me nonetheless. And so it turned out not to be a debilitating issue. So we want to take a look at the things that make us effective. And for a lot of us here in CISO Tradecraft, we're CISOs, VPs, directors, aspiring to be CISOs rather than people. But some people enter into the career and they say, hey, I'm going to check out this particular podcast. And so advice for people, but then targeting really our core audience. You say, how do we change? What are the things that you think people can do when they recognize that they, A, they're in a stressful environment and they can see that in terms of their physiology as well as just their ability to get things done and the thing. And then is what's actionable? What things can people do differently or do better or not do that would help move them toward a better, more sustainable state?
So that's a large question, put it that way, and we answer it from an individual, team, and organizational standpoint. So the idea here is that, one, we all can benefit from learning some skills on how to be more effective people, make more effective decisions, be healthier, and try to reach our potential in that aspect. So from that standpoint, it's the industry refers to them as soft skills, which I think has done a really detrimental component to that whole idea of, we look at these as performance skills. If you want to perform in your career, if you want to perform the best in your personal life, whatever pursuits you're undertaking, then you really need to understand yourself on a deeper level. Who are you and what do you stand for? That's really values-based components in terms of what are the primary values that drive your words, thoughts, and your actions. That for us is foundational and first and foremost. That then guides your ability to say, okay, if I'm faced with a certain situation or decision, how do I want to respond? What do I have control over? Because when we tend to focus on things that we have no control over, we end up irritated, annoyed, pissed off, frustrated, angry, etc., which takes us out of being our best. So that connects back into that survival instinct, lizard brain components. So understanding what we have control over really allows us to empower ourselves into when there's fear, doubt, uncertainty, which there is plenty of that in cybersecurity. How do we actually lean into the things that are stable and allow us to thrive more so than lean into those fears? And that's focusing on what you have control over.
And you'd mentioned something that I wrote down because I thought it was really key. Core values. What is the relationship between our core values and our susceptibility to stress?
So the challenge here is that when we're not living in alignment or congruency with our core values, we start to feel a lot of instability mentally, emotionally, even physically. So the idea is, I'm smiling a little bit because the work that I've done over the past several years, just doing workshops across the country and speaking engagements, the workshops are really interesting because I have a variety of ways that we kind of teach how to connect into those values. And the amount of adults that have said, oh, I really have not done this work ever, is really shocking and disheartening to me. So the idea is, like, if you don't know what values in the 3 to 5 that are your primary core values driving your words, thoughts, and your actions, and who you are and what you stand for, you really are susceptible to the environment and being just really reactive to the external demands, either by a boss, by other business leaders, or whatever it is, or just the external environment in and of itself, right? So without that, you have no ability to be a full, true, effective leader of your own life. And there's a lot of people that are in that situation. So the idea is those values allow you to have an anchor towards any of the chaotic winds of life, so to speak.
Interesting. So I think that when we look at our ability to think strategically versus tactically, to be emotionally versus logically engaged. There's a lot of different facets of personality. And like leadership, one of the things we used to do in a lot of organizations that look at things such as the Myers-Briggs type indicator, the MBTI, where there's 16 different permutations of, are you an extrovert or an introvert? Are you intuitive or sensing? Are you thinking or feeling? Are you judgmental or perceptive? And I always had typed out as ENTJ. And you look that thing up and it says, yeah, commandant, you go ahead and run things. Well, I'm wondering, is that like a condition of my environment having been trained as a military officer? But I did have one tour of duty where I worked with somebody who is a, what we would call a screamer, a yeller, and it was always show me in writing, show me in writing, show me in writing. And being an intuitive person doesn't work when you have somebody who is absolutely show me in writing. And so the one time, only time I ever did a Myers-Briggs, right, was not an ENTJ. I was pushed into the ESTJ, trying to sense instead of intuitive, basically show me in writing. And that's probably 2/3 of my medical record. And that was only a 2.5-year tour. But I had such a low level problem here, this thing, it all manifested, it came out in other ways. And fortunately, I was young, so I didn't have to worry about having a heart attack or anything like that. But lots of low level health issues. My body was saying, my mind was saying, no, you are in a very unhealthy environment. At the time, though, because you're in the military, you don't have much choice about it. You just suck it up and off you go. And in the business world, a lot of times we feel that we can't just up and leave, depending upon what the economy's doing, what our next future is, particularly for folks now getting very concerned with the advent of AI and how it's impacting. For example, it seems to have the biggest impact potentially on entry-level jobs. We send our kids, they say, get a computer science degree like mom or dad, and you'll do great. And then the class of 2024 and 2025 come out, and they're like, oh, what's going on? There's nothing here. So they said, I'm going back to grad school. I'm going to avoid reality for another year. And oh, by the way, you're paying the bills. Thank you, parents. But at some point in time, they have to face the real world. That's a problem for another day, but I bring that up as a context for this question. What is the impact on AI going to be for cybersecurity, more senior positions? Is it going to be, so what? Is it going to be catastrophic? Where do you think it's going to be, recognizing it's a prediction, not a prescription?
So a couple of things. The AI concept in terms of what it's currently able to do, what it's projected to be able to do, it's the impact is profound. The challenge is it's not like prior technologies or revolutions in the economy where it took decades for things to change. The change is coming a lot quicker and a lot sooner. So that creates a lot of fear and uncertainty for a lot of people. Also, because of that, the fear, human beings are not really good and able to predict the future.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that, when we try to look forward and try to predict things, we're trying to figure that out based upon our own knowledge sets. We don't predict well. We also have no control over what's happened in the past. So that being said, that's why it's so important for us to understand what we have control over, which is the present moment. And there's very little that we have control over. So I think that in and of itself is where I come from, in the sense of, what do you have control over? And how do you manage what's important to you, which is your values, right? So with these changes, I also like to highlight the fact that before cars, we had horses. The younger generation is maybe not so aware of the fact of like what that looked like, having horses in the street and dealing with all that. But then we also had a full economy around horses. So the idea being, there was people employed to pick up horse manure in Chicago and LA and New York City by tens of thousands. When the car was invented and came along, that disrupted the horse economy and industry. And all of those jobs picking up horse manure in those cities are now gone. So this is just a continued iteration of another technology and tool. So the idea is, how can we start to understand how to utilize that tool more effectively, opposed to looking at it as like it's going to cause a lot of pain and harm, and it's going to create a lot of change, which is where that pain and harm comes from. But the more that we can understand what we're meant to be doing and what our purpose is and how to align that by utilizing and leveraging that technology, the better off people are going to be.
Right. And it kind of comes back to the old serenity prayer in a way, give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, And of course, the wisdom to know the difference. So we get down to the last couple of minutes of the show. I wanted to ask you about something. The 1st Earth Battalion. We talked about this in the pre-show. We kind of giggled about it. But tell me why that's important, but recognize we only got 5 minutes on the shot clock.
So the short of it is, I grew up with Star Wars, always wanted to be Obi-Wan Kenobi. And this movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats, I watched 15 years ago. The start of it is a black screen with white lettering that says, "More of the story is true than you would expect." So I was automatically intrigued, and the story goes through, and it's some very non-mainstream type of concepts in it. But the idea behind this is that you can actually order the operating manual for the 1st Earth Battalion. After Vietnam, the U.S. military felt like they lost their souls and wanted to avoid the Vietnam type of conflict going forward. So they created this group to be a peacekeeping group called the 1st Earth Battalion. They were in the highest ranks of the U.S. military. They created the tagline for the Army of "Be All You Can Be" because they wanted to maximize human potential. And so the idea was that they were creating warrior monks, and their internal program was referred to as the Jedi program. They did a lot of stuff, and one of the main components that they created was remote viewing. They heard that the Russian military was using telekinetics and psychokinesis to infiltrate other opposing armies or entities, whatever you want to call it. And so that's what started this whole push towards them trying to develop their telekinetic skills. And so out of that, a lot of it is really just, how do you make the world a better place? It's mind, body, spirit development. But I actually got connected with that group and trained with the head of the martial arts division for them, who George Clooney's, his character is based on him in the movie. And so the idea was, how do you make the world a better place? And there's very small components that you can do. If you like gardening, learn how to garden, connect with others that like to garden, and then teach people how to garden. And that's your impact on making the world a better place.
And it's kind of interesting to think that it's been nearly 50 years since that first Star Wars came out in 1977. And of course, we didn't declare victory. We kind of exited Vietnam in 1975. So there wasn't that much of a difference between it. And I always liked the Bill Murray in Stripes, who said, "We're America, we're 10-1. And it's it's the judgment after that. But it's a very good point there, is that, yeah, we've got to recognize that the solutions to the problems that we have now may not come from the same level of knowledge and ability that we use to create the problems. Now we're back to Einstein, right? We need a different level of thinking and things like that. So a lot of people over the generations have thought and pondered on this. We're not new to this. So let's follow up. And how do people get more information? How do they get a copy of the full report? As I said, I'll put this into the show notes, but greenshoeconsulting.com/stateofstress. You can get this nice little...
If you just go to greenshoeconsulting.com, there's a tab for the state of stress report. You just put your name and email in there. There's no spamming. We just send you the report directly and track who's downloading. But the idea is that the more that we can spread the word, the more that we can continue these efforts, the more that we can make some positive change in the industry.
And Steve, any last thoughts of words of wisdom for our folks that are watching or still listening?
I would say... a big aspect in the industry is isolating when you're overly stressed and feeling burnt out, which is opposite of what we need to be doing. So the idea behind this is that we have a very unique community of professionals. We're all struggling with things. We're all dealing with a very hard job in terms of what we're dealing with. So connect with others, speak about it more. The idea that we've traditionally just not shared these things because there's been an implied or subtle focus of, we don't really care what's going on with you mentally and emotionally, that makes it hard to do the job. Shut up and do the job because you're getting paid well.
Yep.
That doesn't work. So there's a different way to be, much like Einstein and what you were saying. We need to think differently and act differently in order to change the industry. And there is the ability to change.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your insights and your wisdom and for sharing this and your contribution to the community. For those who are watching or listening, thank you for being part of our audience at CISO Tradecraft. We hope that we were helping you with your career and, of course, now with your life. If you think so, go ahead and give us a thumbs up or a 5-star, whatever it is. Not because we're grade grubbing. Doesn't affect my compensation one bit, but it does help other people find where we are and it can help them with their cybersecurity career journey as well. I'm your host, G. Mark Hardy. Thank you very much for being part of our show. Steve Shelton with Green Shoe Consulting. Thank you for your insights. That's great. And for everybody else out there, until next time, stay safe out there.
Thanks, G-Mark.